Okay. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming on this beautiful day of May. We're once again happy to host a RAND session. We have four guest speakers today that are going to be talking about new tools and some reports that have been created for ease of research administration. To start with, our first speaker is Dr. Rosie Goldstein. She's the Vice Principal, Research and International Relations, where basically OSR is housed. So Rosie is a graduate of McGill and has returned to McGill in December of 2010 to lead VPRIR. She has spoken here, I believe, is our first session, and so we're happy to have her back today. She will be talking about research performance, basically revenues and where we rank compared to other institutions. So Rosie will be presenting that, and after that, we will have Mary Margaret Klempa, who's the Senior Director of Office of Sponsored Research. She'll be going over our current version, our draft version of an updated OSR checklist, which we're really excited to roll out very soon, but it will be in a draft format, and Mary will go over that draft format. After that, we will have Salima Janmohad. I practiced, sorry. Communication and Training Officer, Finance Infrastructure and Support of Financial Services. And we're hoping that many of you have heard about the new Delegation of Signing Authority menu that has been recently launched. So Salima will be doing a run-through of that new tool for you. And after that, we will have LV Coletta, who's the Director of Research Financial Management Services, who will be providing a run-through of a new tool that will fund profile balance report, which is a really, really, really nice tool. Again, we're super excited about it. So I will leave the floor to Rosie.
Thank you, Marlene. So I'm not going to present any new tools, but I'm very appreciative of the new tools that are being developed and being presented, and I'm happy to be back at the Research Administration Network, or RAN. And I did, some of you may know that I present this kind of report to Senate and Board of Governors, and this is an adaptation of that presentation. So I hope you'll find it interesting, and we'll have a little bit of time for questions at the end, I hope, as well. So thank you for inviting me, and like I said, I'll try to do this in 15 minutes to have time for questions. And I want to start with my main messages. Basically, we should feel good about the funding at McGill. I want to impart to you that we are doing relatively well, and relatively well compared to other institutions and also to our past performance. We have had in the last year or so, I should start by saying that by its nature, because of the way research revenue is reported, I'll be reporting today on the fiscal year 2010-11, because those are the latest complete data that are available from the federal government, and provincial sources, we have 2011-12. So we're always working or talking about a year or two ago. I have to say that we will have the newer 11-12 very soon, but right now I can only report to you from that year. So keep that in mind. And my sense and the numbers I do have is that the numbers are stable or increasing in some areas over the last year or so. So most of what I'm going to tell you still holds true. In the year I'm talking about, 10-11, we did have quite a substantial increase in research funding, about 9, almost 10%, and we also stayed stable in our market share, and we moved up significantly in research intensity from the fourth place to second place, all of which I'm going to explain what those terms mean. But I want to, so we're doing relatively well. I want to highlight, to begin with, that although we're doing relatively well percentage-wise, the funding pie, and I'll show you how we depend mainly on federal and provincial government funding, and it's probably not news to you that that funding pie is quite constrained. It's not getting any larger, and in fact, relatively speaking, it's probably getting smaller, so relative to our costs in particular. So although we're doing relatively well, the dollar amounts don't go up very much, and we don't have a lot of room to maneuver to, even as we push for higher performance, which we always do, to really expand and become remaining competitive, we are not able to really continue to grow and expand, and that's what we want to do. So it really means that we have to diversify our funding sources. I think most people will not find that surprising, at least not for me, because I've been saying that since I got here a few years ago. And I hope you have seen that I'll talk about some of the strategies we're using, and I know that many of you are helping us with, to build our to build this diversity into the funding, to build our strategic institutional grant success, the large grants like the CERCs, the Canada Excellence Research Chairs, the National Centres of Excellence, expand our success and applications to what was MDIE, the government, provincial government, is now MEREST, and also, most importantly, to expand our funding from business, philanthropy, foundations, in other words, the non-traditional funding sources. So I'm sure that also impacts on the work of research administrators and faculty to expand your knowledge and be able to apply successfully to more and more sources. So I'll talk also about implementation improvements. Part of RAN is part of that improvement as well. I always start, especially to Board and Senate, but also to you, by explaining why we always talk about this, because we do talk about research performance and revenue quite a lot. Understanding that the quality of research is also not always measured in dollars, and there are other, but today's talk is really about dollars. So I admit that, and unashamedly. And part of why it's we always talk about it is not only for many reasons. The obvious one is that the direct funding of research is very important in order to be able to do the research that researchers at McGill want to do and are so capable of doing. That's obvious and direct. But there are maybe a little bit less obvious why research funding performance is so important. Research funding performance affects all of these allocations on this slide and also our ranking and reputation. So probably many of you know that the Canada Research Chairs, Canada Excellence Research Chairs, the graduate awards, particularly Banting and Vanier, among the most prestigious awards our students can get, indirect costs of research, some undergraduate research awards, our envelope to apply for Canada Foundation or CFI awards are all affected directly, particularly mostly by our performance on tri-agency federal funds. So as well in our rankings, and I used Times Higher Education World University Rankings, research revenue performance is not the only criteria used in those rankings, but it is a very important criteria, often 30% to 50%. So really just to show you that it's not only about funding the research directly, but it's also about enabling our full potential in the research sector. There's other funding that it affects, and also our rankings and reputation, all of which is very important to us. So all that to say, that's why we talk about it a lot. This is the year 2010-2011, at a glance, the sponsored research revenue at McGill. So this is all the funding we bring in to fund research from all sources. In 10-11, it was $510 million. It's actually really $523. That's through accounting year-end changes that I'm not going to get into, but I've left it at $510 million because that's what you see published on the web. The important points I wanted to mention is that this is a great increase over 2002, I think it was, where we were about 250, about a quarter of a billion. So we're now over half a billion. So there's been an amazing increase over a decade or so in the total research funding. The distribution has not changed that much between the sources. What I wanted to highlight is that 54% of our research funds come from the federal government, and that's mostly what we call tri-agency, NSERC, CIHR and SHRC and CFI. The provincial is almost 20%, again, mostly from Les Trois Fonds, FRQ, if I get the letters right, FRQS, FRQNT, and FRSC, the equivalent of the three federal agencies. You'll see that the other areas, what I call the non-traditional, the not-for-profit foundations, corporations or industry, philanthropy, endowments, international, form about a quarter. So really minor amounts, and this is where I see the potential for growth. Another way of putting this is that between federal and provincial government, you get we have about three quarters of our funding is dependent on government funding. So again, to the point that this part of the pie here is not getting any larger, as I mentioned earlier. We really have to work on, we have to continue to work here very hard to maintain our, I'll show you, to even maintain our share and definitely to grow it, and we're doing well there, but that will only get us so far. That's limited. We really have to work in these areas where the pie is not as constrained and the possibilities are more open. I won't dwell on this slide very much. It's really just to show you that this is similar to the pie, but over the last decade. And what you can see is there are some fluctuations. This is federal funding, provincial, and then the others. There are fluctuations up and down, 5, 10%, but in general, over that time, the percentages remain around the same. And we've always been mostly funded by the government and then other sources to a lesser extent. So I want to spend a little bit of time on the two major, the two really important major areas we talk about research performance, which is, as I've already alluded to, tri-council or tri-agency at the federal level, TWFO at the provincial level, and show you a little bit about how we're doing when we start to break it down. So overall, as I mentioned, we are doing quite well compared to the other universities in Canada. We are in the top five, in fact, in the top four in total dollars in U15 in every way you slice it with the tri-agencies. I wanted to explain market share is McGill's percentage of the total funding available, in this case from tri-agency in Canada. So when you look at market share, you can see that we are also third. We capture 8.2% of the funding available from these agencies. We're behind University of Toronto at 13.9%, almost 14%. And although they're much bigger, they're more than twice as big as us. And University of British Columbia at 9.3%, which is a school that's pretty close to our size. So we're third there in total dollars, which is actually pretty good. But you can see also that we are losing a little bit of market share. We were losing quite a lot in the beginning of the 2000s, 2004, 2005. We're stabilizing. We're losing less. It's minus 0.1%. But you can see that it's difficult to hang on. And what's interesting when you look more deeply at this data is that it's not the other G5 universities, except UBC sometimes, University of British Columbia. It's not the top five universities that are pushing us out. It's the other universities. It's the 10, I call them the U15 minus 5. It's number 6 to 15 research-intensive universities who are trying harder, doing well, and if each one ekes out 0.1, 0.2%, they take it from the top five. And even the ones below U15 that are not as research-intensive, all of them are trying to be more research-intensive. They have more margin to move, actually. They put in more effort, and they capture a little bit. So it's difficult to hang on to and to grow our market share. Research intensity is a little bit of a fairer number I like to look at because it's defined as the research dollars divided by the full-time professorial count. So I use that more during this presentation. It is a fairer representation for McGill, which is a middle-sized university, because it corrects for our size. So if we look at research intensity, we're second behind University of Toronto again in the country. We were fourth just a couple of years ago. We've moved up. We're actually on the margin between 2 and 3. Our goal is really to stay at number 2 this year and next probably, and then move up to number 1, where we were at the beginning of the last decade. So in the early 2000s, we were number 1 in research intensity, and we did slip quite a bit when others grew. And the others are U of T, UBC, and University of Montreal. So you can see where we have our competition and where we have our work cut out for us. So if you look at the three funds, you'll also see that most of our loss in market share over the years was in CIHR, whereas I don't probably have to tell this crowd there's been intense competition from mostly the U15 who have medical schools like McGill does. We're still losing the most in the CIHR. We're losing less, but it is a difficult struggle. And we remain third in research intensity again behind, it's always behind U of T and UBC. In NSERC, we are fourth in research intensity. I have to check. It's behind U of T, UBC, and I don't know which other school it was. I apologize. It might be University of Montreal. I'm not sure. But in any case, we are growing up. We are improving our market share in NSERC. We're still fourth in research intensity. What's really nice to see is we are moving up in SHRC, and we are first in research intensity. We've maintained first or second and first in the last few years. So this is really... To conclude, to tell you that since 2008, we are improving in our market share. We're currently stable or increasing in NSERC and SHRC, but more effort is needed in the CIHR area. And really to highlight that this second in research intensity is something we're really proud of, but we have to hang on to it. It's by no means certain, as others are also working in this direction. We're not doing as well in the TWFO and Quebec. I'm pretty sure this year's statistics will be better, but I don't have them to prove it yet. It's less dollars overall, but it's important. As you saw, it's 20% roughly of our funding, and I think it's also our reputation in Quebec, where we are frankly lagging for a research-intensive university that ranks so highly in Canada. We're not punching our weight in Quebec, and we've looked at various reasons, and I think we are improving. So McGill got $27 million in 11-12 from the TWFO, second behind University of Montreal, which received $46 million. Now, University of Montreal is larger than McGill, But we have got 18.3% of the market share, and again, we're behind U2M. They get 31% of the market share. We were decreasing early on in this earlier this decade, but now we are increasing. We're stable. You can see where we're increasing, especially in FRQSC. So the efforts in the science, in the social science and humanities, are there and are paying off. And we have to put more effort again in the health area, especially, but also in natural science and engineering. You can see we tend to be second behind U to M. U to M is first in all the categories. In FQRNT, we're behind University of Laval, and in FQRSC, we're behind Laval, Montreal, in this order: Montreal, Laval, and UCAM. Which, as you probably know, UCAM is very strong in social science and humanities, but we're number one research-intensive university in SHRC, which is the same as SC. So it doesn't make sense. It shows that our effort is not reaping the rewards it should in Quebec. So you can see market share here, the trends where we're increasing, but also I think it's very telling that we're behind University of Montreal and U to M and Laval in all of the research intensity rankings, where we could certainly be number one. There's no question in that. I'll talk a little bit about what we're doing to get some gains in Quebec. So just a few points on commercialization, which I know is not the subject probably of most of your RAN, but I do present this to board and Senate because it also is important. And really to highlight the point that in commercialization and knowledge translation, McGill does reasonably well in terms of being ranking in Canada. We're kind of the middle of the pack. We're at near the top, certainly ranked fifth for invention disclosures and patents. So I like to summarize by saying we're very good at patenting our inventions. We probably could receive more disclosures, and we're certainly going out there to solicit, to educate professors on this and help them disclose their inventions. I think we're very good at patenting, and like I say, we rank five in the country that way. Where there is room for improvement is in actually getting those patents and those inventions out into the real world, I like to call it, into the market and into the community. So we have to improve our collaboration with industry, our active licensing, and moving discoveries to market and community. So for example, we do, in 2011, McGill had 174 active licenses, but we're far behind our G5 peers. UBC had over 300. Alberta, a smaller school than us, are roughly the same, 258. On the other hand, we're way ahead of other Quebec universities. The next one is U2M, who had only 64 active licenses. So what I like to say is, if we compare ourselves only in Canada, we're doing okay. We're in the middle of the pack. But if you dig down into the numbers, and probably you read the news, Canada is not doing that well in innovation and in moving discoveries to the market. So really, there's not that much to be proud of. We do what we do with the patents and what I said with a very small staff. My staff always likes me to remind, always reminds me, so I'll remind you, that we have a very small staff in the commercialization office and a very capable staff. And they do an excellent job with less numbers than these other schools. It's more that I think we haven't concentrated on the next steps, and not that we're not able to do them. And I think part of the presentation today is to make people realize that we need to do much better, that Canada is not punching at its weight. Therefore, McGill and the other institutions, UBC, U of T included, are not punching our weight. And we can look at where other countries that are really doing much better. We have only to look to the south, to the U.S., where they're performing much better in terms of taking inventions of all sorts, including from universities to market. So one example I like to give is that the top performer in the U.S. in licensing income is Northwestern University in Chicago, who bring in almost $200 million a year. I don't even want to tell you what McGill and schools in Canada bring in, but let's say it's not in those numbers of figures. It's in double-digit millions or single-digit millions, not triple-digit. It's not in the $100 million range anywhere in Canada. University of California system is closely behind at about $180 million. So really, we want to do better in that area. And our approach has been to improve the collaboration with industry and other partners who can help us bring inventions to market. We want to streamline our patent portfolio, and we just frankly want to have a more concerted effort to bring our discoveries into improvements in the community. So what are the opportunities? I've talked about how we're doing and the challenges. I want to finish off just talking about all of the opportunities, and I've talked about diversity and the competition, not just from U15, but from other universities. And with the changing landscape, I think it leaves us no choice but to diversify our sources of income, and that's what we're doing. There's a lot of opportunity with foundations. We're closing at McGill a very successful campaign, McGill, that's really laid the groundwork for this kind of philanthropy and will help our fundraisers better focus their their efforts and help us raise more money for research. It also means that at RIR, we are working much more closely with DAR, Development and Alumni Relations, on files related to foundations. I know there's a workshop coming up soon, for example, to teach administrators and faculty about foundations and how to apply, et cetera. So we're going to be much more aggressive with that. Through our ties, we're improving our ties with industry. Two examples of projects that are other presentations themselves, which I'd be happy to give you, are our unique partnership with ETS. Many of you may know that Cartier d'Innovation was launched officially this past Monday. This will improve our relationships with companies and not-for-profits. And we've also, over the last year or so, piloted a project that we call MUBEC, or the McGill University Business Engagement Center, again, to implement a streamlined and holistic approach to partnering with leading companies and small companies. International programs are another area of great potential for growth, especially European programs, including, for example, European programs such as FP7, also international foundations. I should add, McGill is number one in many of those international pursuits, but it's still very small. And we are number one because we're the best at it, so we just have to crank up what we do well so we can bring in more funds for our research. And we also are very active in working with government in advocating for the right kinds of research policies that will support funding at excellent research universities, including McGill, and also to help government create the right environment for research and innovation, both for universities and for companies. Federal government has just launched their consultation in this area, and we are actively involved. And at the province, you should know that they are launching in June. We will have the announcement of the PNRE, which is the Politique Nationale de Recherche et de l'Innovation. It replaces what used to be called the strategy, SQRE. It's now a politique or policy, but we envision that there will be opportunity and funds for research for McGill and other Canadian universities there. So it's for us to really seize those challenges. We also are, from the RIR's perspective, working through the strategic research plan that I hope you're familiar with to bring solutions to these challenges to McGill and help. Last spring, we held our first internal seed funding competition that was aimed at early-stage collaborative and interdisciplinary projects. I should say it's still aimed, and we've just launched the second year of that. So that's a two-year pilot project that we hope will continue. We're emphasizing the need to apply for Quebec funding, particularly putting an emphasis and encouraging teams to be put together for Regroupement Stratégique or Quebec networks. We noticed that part of the funding problems, part of the funding envelope, and why ours market share is smaller than UDEM is they tend to lead these regroupements, whereas McGill has not tended to lead these regroupements in the past. So we're improving and increasing our support for the regroupement, increasing our translation and support services in general for the French language grant applications. And I think we don't have the statistics, but I do know that we had two FQRNT renewals this spring. We had the largest funding envelopes over the full period of 6 years than any other university got for those two awards. So I think our efforts are working, and I encourage you to continue that. We're also increasing our targeted in-house support for large grants, some of which I mentioned. One example from last year is BiofuelNet Canada, are the first NCE that McGill has led in at least a decade that brought in nearly $25 million in funding, and we're working on the next round of NCE applications and various others, and again, the new approaches to commercialization that I mentioned. That's what we're doing more centrally, but we're also asking you and McGill researchers to do your part. It is a two-way street, and we must work together towards these goals. Some of this may seem obvious, but it isn't always, so I like to emphasize that researchers have to apply, and we have to help researchers apply for the maximum funding on grants. We should not undercut ourselves, and we need to apply for the amount of funding that's allowed and that is realistic in order to cover our costs. And sometimes we don't do that. We have to know our funders, and partly centrally we try and help faculties and researchers understand what funders are looking for, but it's also every researcher's responsibility and the faculties to understand it well, and this can be misunderstood. This is not about doing the research that the funding agency tells you to do or not doing what you want to do, but it is about expressing researchers' ideas and questions and framing the research proposals in the right way. And also, we often have to apply to multiple agencies, and so putting the right research proposals forward to the right funders and not the other way around so that you can get funded. Funders, particularly philanthropists and foundations, are getting more and more particular about their goals and objectives and what they're going to fund. And I think we have to be attuned to that. If we simply throw against the wall, I think as we have in the past, what we want to do, it may be great research, but it really has to match what the funding program criteria are. And I think sometimes we lose out simply because we're not paying attention to those details, and we need to be more attentive to those. Sometimes if a program, so again, I want to emphasize, it's not about forcing researchers or yourselves to do research that you don't want to do. It's more about, and sometimes we may find the fit's not good. I think it's more realistic to look at a funding program, and if your research doesn't fit that program, it's better. We'd prefer that you see that at the beginning. If you don't have research that you want to do that fits those objectives, then look to another program. Look to another funding agency. It doesn't, as long as we're very clear on it, we have to be well educated so we don't make mistakes and miss opportunities as well. We're always emphasizing quality and excellence. It's not about changing the research to fit something and lowering the standard, not at all, never. And we also want to utilize internal and external review processes more. We're trying to put those in place. We're encouraging faculties and to put those kinds of mentoring and peer review processes in place. There's lots of data that this works, and we're seeing it already, and we really ask researchers to utilize these. It's often, as a pain. It means internal OSR deadlines. It means internal faculty deadlines. I really believe that in many cases it really does pay off. So I'll close with a few research funding highlights, again from 2012. There are more of these in 2013. I mentioned FQR&T that are not on the slide yet. I already mentioned the NCE for BiofuelNet that we're very proud of. SHRC partnership grants last year, we got two, one to Professor Trocmé in Arts on Child Protective Services, and the other to Professor Suzanne Lajoie in Education. These grants also came with significant CFI funding. We got two NSER Create grants last year, one in Green Chemistry, Professor Lee, and the other in Medical Imaging Analysis to Professor Siddiqui in Medicine. And I could go on and on. We did get FRQSC funds to Professor Elizabeth Dengel in Arts, CAHR and Genomics. This was a $7.5 million grant to the Genome Center, Mark Lathrop and Guillaume Burke. We have a new Genome Canada grant to Nadia Jabado in Medicine, which is, I think, around $6 million in personalized medicine. Also a great success. And two of the 11 Canada Excellence Research Chairs awarded in 2012, and we're now in the process of recruiting those two CERCs, were awarded two McGills. That's two out of 11 in the country. Each of those is $10 million from the federal government and $10 million matched from Quebec, plus some other matching we were getting from philanthropy and from McGill funds. So these are $20 million plus awards each we can be very proud of, one in green chemistry and the other in pain medicine. We also get a lot of, we have wonderful researchers and we get a lot of awards, and my office supports these nominations, as do many of the faculties, and as many of our faculty members and staff who put in the work to nominate these people. These are the highlights, or others, and I do want to highlight especially last year, 8 Royal Society of Canada fellows inducted from McGill. This is the highest honour to a scholar in Canada. 3 medals and 1 prize, which is a Canadian, I have verified it's a McGill record, but it's also a Canadian university record to have that many medals in the Royal Society in 1 year. So with that, I will end, and I have a few minutes for questions. Marlene.
Can you clarify what G5 and U16
mean? Oh, sorry. G5 are the top 5 universities, research-intensive universities in Canada. Sorry, I should have defined that. And that is U of T, UBC, McGill, UDM, and University of Alberta. So, and it's defined by research revenues. The 15, I can't rhyme them all off, I'll forget one or two, are the top 15. And so you could slice them other ways. Some people talk about the U3, which is U of T, UBC, McGill. But generally speaking, those are the groupings that are used in the statistics, U5 and U15. So thank you to all of you. Thank you for putting on RAN, and thank you for all the work you do to really make the research performance happen. It's not my office that does that. It's all of you and the researchers and the faculty that do the work that bring the funds in, and we work hard to assist you, we hope, successfully to do that. Thank you.
our slideshow.
It's continuous. Oh, clever.
And then you just click on that, and it'll pop up.
Okay, perfect. Good morning, everyone. My name is Mary Margaret Klempa. I'm, as Marlene said, I'm the Senior Director of the Office of Sponsored Research. So today I'm going to walk you through the updated OSR checklist. Many of you may be familiar with our checklist. Researchers are certainly familiar with it. It's kind of the bane of their existence. They see it as just additional paperwork that they have to submit with their application. But really, it's a tool that we need to, that we require for every single application and contract that is submitted through the Office of Sponsored Research, and even for grants that bypass, because often researchers bypass our office and we only get their application once it's awarded, or in the case of contracts as well, there's not an application process, but we do need that checklist to be completed and fully executed before we can approve a fund and have it opened up in Research Financial Management Services. So it's an important tool for the Office of Sponsored Research. We use the information that's reported in the checklist to populate our database. It's also an important tool for to alert us to follow up on certain compliance issues at the award stage, like animals, human ethics, controlled goods, biohazards, etc. And it's also an important tool for departments and faculties, because this is the form that alerts them to the fact that researchers are submitting an application, and it's the means by which they give their approval to certain administrative aspects of the research that's going to be carried out, especially in the age of online submissions now, where you know researchers just submit directly either to us or directly to the agency. It's really important that we have this tool that, that gets the required approvals before submission and before the award is set up. So we're always reviewing our checklist to make sure that it's up to date, that the questions are clear, et cetera, with a view to improving it to make it, you know, easier for researchers to use, because we do know that they see it as an additional burden. So the last revision was about 2 or 3 years ago, and the motivation for this current checklist was that we found that some of the questions really weren't that clear, so we tried to improve the clarity of them. And we also needed to add some additional questions to respond to some new compliance requirements, like financial conflict of interest, some requirements from tri-agency, et cetera. In addition, we added some questions to alert us to when there's going to be a sub-award for a grant, which is really important at the award stage. If we know there's going to be a sub-award out to another university and we have this information on the checklist, we can be more proactive in getting the award set up and getting the sub-award out to the participating institution. So I think that our new checklist will really help us with some of these things. And right now it's just in draft format. We're still working on it. It's not complete. We're still improving it, and we hope to launch it in the next couple of months. It's been through several iterations in the past few weeks just within the Office of Sponsored Research. I expect we'll present it to our Research Advisory Committee, which is made up of Associate Deans of Research, and then hopefully we'll finalize it and launch it this summer. So now I'm really just going to walk you through it. So it's an interactive form. It's a PDF form fillable. What we would really like, and what we've been trying to get for the past few years, is a savable checklist, so that researchers don't have to fill in the same information all the time. Their McGill ID, their name, their department, etc. We're not there yet. If researchers do have Adobe Professional, though, I think they can save this and just recycle it, but you do need Adobe Professional in order to be able to save it. So what we've done, and actually I have to admit, we kind of stole the template from the University of Toronto. But they're aware of that. I was talking with the associate VP from University of Toronto the other day, and I told her that we had stolen their template, and they're quite happy to share tools and best practices. So I think we're okay. But what we tried to do with this version is really organize it according to the information collected. So it's organized by theme, I guess. So we have the section for the principal investigator, which gives, you know, it's all the information required, their ID, their phone number, their their faculty of primary importance. And that's important because we do have to enter the, in our database, we have to enter under the primary appointment. There's many researchers who have joint appointments, and they'll try to, you know, switch off to the other faculty, but we do need the primary appointment and their department school. So, it's interactive. As I said, there's drop-down menus, and if you choose, for example, the Faculty of Arts, then you'll have the list of departments that come up under the Faculty of Arts, and you can choose one. The unit administering funds, if different from the primary department, that's where a researcher may have a joint appointment in two different faculties. So if they enter their primary appointment, they can enter another department just to administer the funds, but they need double signatures in that case. So then under the project section, we have all the information that needs to be entered related to the project. So the title, the originating sponsor, and again, we have drop-down menus for the major sponsors, and if you choose SHRC, for example, you will get, you know, the most common programs related to SHRC. We have the requested total for the budget, and then here, in most applications, you do have a budget in the application. So the question is there an itemized budget? And if you say no, because in some cases a contract, for example, might not have an itemized budget, you'll be prompted to enter your direct costs, your indirect costs, and your total direct and indirect. This will be changed, this click here. That will take you to the policy on indirect costs, the different rates and policies. So that'll change to policies and rates for indirect costs. It'll take you to our website where you can see for any type of application, whether it's a grant, a contract, a clinical trial, et cetera, it will give you the specific rate that you need to include there. So as I mentioned before, we've added this question, is this a sub-award to McGill? And if you answer yes, then you'll be prompted to enter the name of the lead PI and the name of the lead institution. So this tells us that if the application is awarded, we're not going to get notified. It's the lead institution that will get a notification. But we may, you know, with this information, it will allow us to be proactive in following up with the lead institution so that we can, you know, find out, we understand that this application has been awarded. Can you let us know if we're going to be getting a subgrant for this award? And we'll have the information right on the checklist. Yeah.
So are you saying that anybody who's an operator?
Sorry, wait.
Microphone.
So does this mean that anytime someone's a co-applicant or a collaborator, well, I guess mostly a co-applicant, they should be filling this out?
Well,
you're saying is this a sub-award, so they wouldn't.
Not necessarily at the application stage, because if they don't require a signature at the application stage where they're a co-applicant, they're not going to fill out the checklist. But if they find out that the grant has been awarded,
then they
would say that this is a sub-award, and it would give us the information on the checklist about who the main PI is and who the lead institution is. So it could be at either stage, because in some cases they will fill it out at the application stage together.
Are we instructing scholars that they should be filling this out at the co-applicant stage?
It helps us. It does help us because if the grant is awarded, then we have to follow up and ask for the checklist and ask for a copy of the application. So it does speed up the process if the grant is awarded. And just feel free to jump in at any time if you have any questions or what I'm saying is not clear. So the next question, will McGill be sub-awarding funds to another organization? So this is the opposite. This is where we are the lead PI, but there's a co-applicant, for example, at Université de Montréal, and the PI has budgeted for costs for that PI. So in this case, the researcher would click yes, and we would get the name of the sub-award organization. We should also get the name of the other PI, and we'll be asking for that to be added to the checklist as well. So again, this will, when the grant is awarded, this will alert our awards staff that there is a sub-award that needs to be dealt with. And they It allows them to be proactive, to follow up with the PI to say, I understand that you're going to be subawarding to Université de Montréal. Can you please let us know how much you want to award? And I think this is going to be really helpful because it's a really big problem across Canada where co-applicants are getting their funds months and months after grants are awarded. And in some cases, you know, a grant could be awarded on April 1st. And we're only getting the sub-award from the other organization, you know, a month before the end of the first year. So I really hope that this will allow us to be proactive on our end and help us to be proactive on the other end as well. Are there requirements for partnerships, collaborations, agreements? Again, this will alert us to the fact if we need to do additional work to get an agreement in place. Does this project involve international, including U.S. collaboration? So again, it's interactive. If you click yes, then you get this drop-down menu, and you can add the countries that are collaborating. This question, will any salary payments be made to the to academic staff from this grant? This is a question that we had to include it as a result of our tri-agency financial monitoring visit because according to the eligibility of funds, if you are eligible to apply for a tri-council grant, so if your status makes you eligible to be able to apply, you cannot be paid from that grant. So, for example, if you're an adjunct professor and you're working on a project with a professor at McGill, that the lead PI cannot budget for salary for you because you yourself are eligible to apply for a grant. So we had no way of catching this, and we went back and forth with the tri-agency to try to figure out a way of monitoring this, and this is the answer that we came up with. So it's a simple question: will any salary payments be made to academic staff from this grant? If they answer yes, this pops up, a grants officer will be communicating with you. So the grants officer would see this on the checklist. They would give the researcher a call and explain that this is actually not allowed. And it also gives a link to the Tri-Agency Financial Administration Guidelines where it specifically says that this is not an eligible cost. Are there any questions about that?
Well, academic staff can be also research associate. That has nothing to do with not the...
Academic staff can also be a research assistant or a research associate, in which case they could probably be paid from the grant because it's not the
we PI. We are aware of that, and that was something that we brought back to the tri-agency, especially for NSERC, for example, a research associate is not eligible. But for SHRC, they would be. And in fact, SHRC has really sort of loosey-goosey eligibility criteria to lead a grant. So we did bring this back to tri-agency, and we basically said, according to your eligibility criteria, a postdoctoral fellow could apply for a grant. So this makes it really difficult for us. So they said, no, that's not what we mean. What we mean really is someone with an assistant professor, an associate, or a full professor position. So it's really specific to, you know, those kinds of categories. So it's hard to explain in a checklist, which is why we were prompting the grants officers to follow up with the researchers so they can investigate a little bit and see if what the professor is asking for is actually okay. Yeah.
The NIH grants allow for academics to receive a portion of that grant.
Absolutely. And this question only pops up if you choose NSERC, SHRC, or CIHR as the prime sponsor.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Here's the location of the research. So this is generally for the affiliated hospitals. So again, we have a drop-down list, and you can choose the research site, or you can enter another research site if yours does not show up on the list. The checklist is, if you look at it as a PDF, it starts off as 3 pages, but the more you answer yes to certain questions, it gets longer and longer, and it could be, I think, up to five pages if you answer a lot of yeses. Classification. So these are keywords that you can enter related to your research proposal, and these really help us if we need to search our database if, you know, we're looking for researchers who are working in a certain area, we can search our data warehouse for these keywords. If you can't find the keywords in the list, you can enter them on the line below. And what happens there is that the people who are doing data entry, they look at the keyword that's been entered. They see if it's not really already in the list or something very similar that they can match it to, or they investigate whether this keyword should actually be added to our list of keywords. So the next section is for CIRU report. This is where we report to the Quebec government. So we have to do an annual report to our Quebec government of all the research funding that we receive, and we need to report certain things. And this is the only place that we can capture this information is on the checklist. So you have to enter at least one CLARTER code. So again, these are research classification codes. So if you click the drop-down menu, it's a list of all the codes. And they're alphabetical, so if you just key the first letter of the code, then it'll take you to the top of the alphabet there. So you can enter one or two. Then it asks, are you a part of a research center, group, or research institute based in Quebec? So again, this has to be reported to CIRU. And if you answer yes, once again, you get a drop-down list of the centers, the CIRU recognized centers. And then finally they ask for the method of research for this project. And you had asked Janie about this. Did she give you an answer? But so, okay, so we're still trying to figure out why we need this question and what, you know, if these are actually relevant methods of research that will make sense to researchers. But this is the list that we have right now: clinical, epidemiological, evaluative, or fundamental. So most of it's going to be fundamental. But again, we're going to clarify why we need that question and if it's actually really clear. So the next section is a fairly long one about compliance. So, you know, these are the basic questions, and most of them were included on our previous checklist. Does your project involve animal subjects? Does your project involve human participants? Does your project involve biohazardous materials? And it gives links to the various websites that explain the policies and procedures related to these compliance issues. Could this research involve controlled goods or export control items? Now, if you answer yes to this, and we hope that you won't, it prompts you to read and complete the controlled goods export control statement below. So that will pop up another form that you have to, you know, it gives links to the various, sorry, that's not it. Here, it gives links to the controlled goods and export-import controls information on McGill's website. It asks, you know, it asks you to make certain confirmations about the research personnel, et cetera, and advise you that certain people may need to be security cleared, et cetera. And then it requires an additional signature there. Same thing for, could this research involve protected classified information and security clearances? It does, again, pop up a similar form which asks basically the same questions and points you to similar websites. So the next section is completely new, and this is because we have revised or are in the midst of revising the financial conflict of interest disclosure and description statements. So these have been revised for about a year now, but we've been having trouble trying to implement them. Ideally, what's going to happen in the future is that these will be implemented by the provost's office, and it will be a requirement for researchers to fill out an annual disclosure statement as part of their annual reporting to their faculty. That hasn't happened yet, but in order to be compliant with certain regulations, especially U.S. regulations related to financial conflict of interest, we have to ask these questions on the checklist because we don't have any other mechanism of asking them. So this may disappear in the near future once the university implements this at a more central level. But for now, this is what we're left with. So it asks more. In the past, the question for conflict of interest was basically, I have read, understood, and complied with the conflict of interest policy. And it gave a link to the policy. And researchers would just click yes or no. And 99.9% of the time they were clicking yes, they've read it. So I, you know, it's easy just to click yes to that kind of question. These are more pointed questions that I think provoke more thought. So researchers will actually have to think about this, and it'll give them more, I guess, motivation to go and look at the conflict of interest policy and try to understand what a conflict of interest really is. So the questions, I'm just going to read them. In the past 12 months, have you or members of your immediate family, spouse, domestic partner, or dependent children, A, been remunerated for consulting activities by an entity whose financial interests directly affect or reasonably appear to influence your research, instruction, or scholarly activity? So if you say yes, for example, this is still in the works, but I'll explain that in a minute. Again, had a significant financial interest, and we will have a link at some point to our website. We'll have a description of what a significant financial interest is, and they'll be able to just click onto that link to go to that website. In an entity whose financial interests directly affect or reasonably appear to influence your research, instruction, or scholarly activity. Been reimbursed or sponsored for travel expenses from an entity whose financial interests directly affect or reasonably appear to influence your research, instruction, or scholarly activities funded or proposed for funding. And finally, received gifts exceeding a value of $500 from an entity whose financial interests directly affect or reasonably appear to influence your research, instruction, or scholarly activity. And then the last question, which will actually stay even once we have the annual disclosure statement done at a more central level, this question will remain on our checklist. Do you have consulting arrangements, line management responsibilities, substantial equity holdings with the sponsor, subcontractor, or potential vendor? So the idea, once we get this finalized, the idea is if they answer yes to any one of these questions, they will be prompted to our website, where they'll find another form, which is a description of financial conflict of interest, of their specific financial conflict of interest. And that will ask a whole other series of questions about their conflict of interest. And then they'll have to follow the procedures related to the conflict of interest policy. So we haven't finalized that yet, but once we launch this, that will all be up and running. Are there any questions about that? Yeah. Hold that microphone. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry if this is silly, but like say number C,
mm-hmm.
Well, you could say, yes, I just got funding from UBC to travel to do research, and if they get research from this grant will influence their financial interests, which will influence my research. Like, how does it, the wording
from an entity? So I'm not sure I understand.
I'm working with UBC. UBC gets a $5 million grant that affects their research or financial interests. What influences my research? Because then I get a sub award to do more research. So.
But is it a conflict, I guess? You'd have to look more closely at the conflict of interest policy to understand what a conflict is. So this will direct you to that site.
Yeah.
We're still trying to work out the whole travel thing because...
Travel would be mostly if, for example, you're being paid by Novartis to go attend and present at one of their board meetings or something, and then you get a grant or a contract from Novartis. You could potentially be in conflict because you're getting paid on one side by them for travel to go attend their board meetings or to go consult for them, but then you're also getting a grant or a contract from them, you could potentially have a conflict there. So it's not as much as UBC gets a big tri-council grant yeah. and then sub-grants to you. The conflict, there would be very little conflict there unless there's an industry partner involved. So if that project involves an industry sponsor, an industry co-funder, and you have a relationship with that industry co-sponsor, even if you're the co-applicant, yeah, you potentially have a conflict. So investigators will really need to be made aware of the conflict of interest policy and kind of, you know, understand that
the travel pertains really to travel expenses paid by an entity that potentially influence or potentially has the ability from an outside viewer to say, oh, you're being paid to attend this, but you're also getting money from them. Did that clarify a little bit?
And in general, I think, I mean, I don't think this is the place to get into conflict of interest because it is complicated, and a lot of people don't understand it fully, and it's viewed negatively as if, you know, if I have a conflict of interest, that's a bad thing. It's not necessarily a bad thing. It just needs to be reported and managed. And we do need to do some education around conflict of interest, and I hope that that will come as we launch these new forms and as we set about revising our current policy, which is due for revision. So the next section is planning and resources. So it asks questions about salary support, and these are all new. These questions about matching funds, basically on the grant. So if the grant involves a contribution from the department or faculty to the direct costs, you would enter the information here. Or if it involves a contribution from another organization to the direct costs, whether it be cash or in kind, you would enter that information here. We're still working on this section, and we hope to have tables where they can actually give specific information about the type of contribution, what it's going for, what budget items are planned to be paid from those contributions. And this is going to be really important for the faculties and departments, especially to confirm if it's a faculty or departmental contribution. They'll see right up front on the checklist that they have to pay special attention to this, and that their signature on the checklist is confirming this contribution. So again, additional space or renovation and course release. So this section, planning and resources, is really important for the department chairs and the faculty associate deans of research to look at and confirm that they agree with whatever has been included in this section. Because I included the Faculty of Arts as my faculty that I was applying from, another question pops up specifically for the Faculty of Arts. And I think currently it's only the Faculty of Arts that has asked for this. Engineering used to ask for specific questions to populate if engineering was chosen. But I think arts is the only one right now, and it just asks about internal funding, internal faculty project. So that's, again, something that the department chair and the associate dean would look at. So this final page is where we collect the signatures. This is a work in progress because it's a little bit confusing right now. There's too many signatures required, and they're not all required in all cases. So what is going to happen, and we're still working on this, is depending on the faculty that you choose, certain signatures will pop up. So for example, if you choose the Faculty of Engineering, you will get you'll always get the signature of the PI, whatever, and you'll always get the signature of the chair. But if you choose the Faculty of Engineering, you will also be prompted to get the signature of the Associate Dean of Research, because the Faculty of Engineering requires the ADR's signature on all checklists. That is the case for almost all faculties. Almost all faculties have their Associate Dean of Research sign on the checklist. The exception is science. Science doesn't care. They allow the chair to sign off, and they don't need an additional sign off from the associate dean. So if you choose science, you'll just get the chair's signature. You won't get all the additional signatures. And then there's other ones for the hospital. So unless you choose a hospital as a research location, you won't be getting those signatures. So this was another motivation of revising this checklist, was to make the signatures, what the signatures mean, more clear. And again, we took a lot of this text from the University of Toronto. But I think it really, you know, if researchers actually take the time to read this, they will understand what their signature means. So it means that the application is submitted in compliance with the sponsor's conditions and the university policies and procedures, that the research shall be performed and administered in accordance with the terms and conditions and the university's policies and procedures. And we added this: the principal investigator has read, understood, and agrees to abide by the research administration roles and responsibilities. So that's the document that was presented in the first RAND session this year. So it's to alert researchers, because I'm not sure that everyone has actually gone through this, but at least this will now alert them to this document, and it makes clear what researcher roles and responsibilities are. that all persons engaged in the project, whether paid or unpaid, shall be properly trained, fully informed of, and agree to be bound by the award agreement slash contract conditions, and that any research involving the use of human subjects, animals, biohazardous agents, radioactive materials, et cetera, will not be undertaken without prior written approval in the appropriate university ethics committees or managing authority. And again, there's a question about conflict of interest. So the principal investigator signs, and then the chair signs. And this, again, we added the research roles and responsibilities, but we also added this line here. I mean, it's really, they're confirming, you know, space, et cetera, that they have the appropriate support to carry out the research. But this line here, C, it really points them to the planning and resources section of the checklist to make sure that they have reviewed that, and their signature here confirms that they review and approve the planning and resources section. So I think that's it. Question over here.
Good morning. I'm in the Department of Epidemiology, and we have a lot of cross appointments with faculty. And previously on these OSR checklists, they only needed the departmental chair and the associate dean if the fund was going to be administered in our department, regardless of where their primary was. But if I understood up above that from now on they'll also need their primary chair signature?
That's right.
Oh, that's nice.
Because if it's their primary appointment, their chair should be aware that that they're submitting an application. Mm-hmm. And that is ultimately the department that will get credited through, for example, the indirect cost program. That's because it's their primary appointment, that's where the credit will go for that grant.
Since you brought it up, the indirect cost program.
You shouldn't have.
No, you shouldn't have.
Big mistake.
Because if I understand correctly, McGill gets about $25 million every year from the federal government for indirect costs.
Something like that.
Yeah, how does that apportion? Where does that go? Who sees that?
That is a very, very complicated
question that you're not going to answer.
Well, it's very complicated. And I had a training session on that only recently, and I don't think we should get into it here, but basically a whole chunk of it goes off to the hospitals first, and it leaves us with very little to distribute, and it's based on the faculty's performance in tri-council programs, essentially. So it works out, I mean, university-wide, it works out to about 18%. 75% is retained centrally, and 25% is distributed to the hospitals and the faculties. So once you take the 70, you know, it turns out to be very, very little money essentially going to the faculties. It's complicated. Are there any other questions about the checklist? Yeah, over here.
Is there any plan in the foreseeable future to make them the approval signatures electronic?
We would love that.
Me too.
We would love that. Yeah, we've been trying to work on that. We're really not there yet. As I mentioned, though, I was speaking with someone from University of Toronto where we stole their checklist from, and they've actually done that. They've embarked on that exercise, and they're using this template, and they have they've just launched it like this week, I think, where, you know, the applicant signs, and depending on the department they choose, it routes it off to their department for signature, and it has all a series of levels of approvals. So I'm going to be talking to University of Toronto more to find out, you know, if that's a solution for us, because we've investigated various solutions and we never seem to get anywhere. But yeah, that is definitely a priority for us, but not in the near future. Like, not definitely not within the next year or two, I don't think. Sorry. Over here? Oh, up there.
The researcher submits the checklist. On the submission, even though the money may not be received. In your database, do you keep in the database every submission that's given?
Yes.
Even if it doesn't go, then?
Yes.
So there is some record of if previous submissions?
Absolutely. Any application that is submitted through our office is entered into our database, and the record stays there, regardless of whether it's awarded. So we can report on success rates, et cetera.
Right. Okay.
In many cases, researchers bypass us, so we don't, you know, the success rates won't be always accurate. But, yeah, for anything that requires our signature where researchers come through our office, it's entered in our database. I think there was a question, Lynn, over here.
Could you define electronic signature?
Could I define electronic signature?
Yeah, like there's different, I mean, I get some researchers will, you know, sign, scan it, and because they're scanning it, they think that's electronic signature. Others will use the actual when it comes from your computer and it has your name.
Yeah.
What can you define electronic as what OSR accepts?
For the checklist, we accept a scan. This is not really a legal document. It's more a tool for us. So we don't define it by, you know, what's legally appropriate for signing a contract, for example. So any electronic signature is fine for us, a fax. I think we accept the actual electronic, the digital signatures as well. So we're very flexible. I mean, we don't need original signatures. If you sign it in blue ink and you fax it to us or scan it, that's fine. If you copy and paste a signature into it as well, I guess that's fine as well.
Hi. If this form is to launch in fall, would OSR work with the McGill software in order to get researchers a free license to the new Adobe Acrobat Professional? Because it is currently, individuals have to procure the license, and it becomes very complex with the length of this document to have people close it accidentally or in an inability to save it.
We hadn't planned on that, but it's a great idea, and I will see if there's something that we can do there. I'll take a note of that. Thank you. Is that it? I think we need to get moving with the other presentations, so thank you very much. If you have any other questions for me, please feel free to approach me after the session. I'd be happy to answer any other questions. Thank you.
Give me a second. I'm just getting organized. There we go. Okay, I'm all set. So my name is Salima Jan Mohammed. I work in financial services, and I'm here to talk to you a little bit about the new Minerva menu option that was launched on Wednesday, which is called the Delegate Temporary Signing Authority. This menu arose out of a tri-agency requirement. It was always there that a principal investigator, a PI, can delegate authority for approval. And what tri-agency had said is that this delegate must possess the skill and knowledge necessary for the effective exercise of the authority. They also mentioned another requirement was that delegation cannot be done for administrative convenience, so it cannot be a permanent delegation. And they also mentioned that another requirement was that there needs to be an audit trail. You need to easily be able to see who is a delegate for when, for how long. So this resulted in a project that Financial Services was a part of, along with the TRIG Advisory Committee, to come up with an online solution. So what was decided was to come up with an online repository of temporary delegation records. What this online repository would be doing is that it would replace two paper forms which were used up until Wednesday, up until May 15th. On the Financial Services website, there were two forms, the Temporary Delegation of Signing Authority, and there was another paper form called the Travel Advance Signature Delegation. So those forms you would print out and complete, and then you would be submitting that to Transaction Services for travel services and for accounts payable to use in order to be able to check for delegation and for signatures. So what arose out of this project was that it was limited to the document types of advances, expense reports, and payment requests. And it was decided that those two forms would now be put online, but that it would be put online in a Minerva menu option. So currently, this new Minerva menu option resides in the Advances and Expense Reports menu. It's applicable to all FFMs, all principal investigators, regardless of fund type. And within this menu, you are able to prepare delegation records. The PI can confirm delegation records. And of course, you can view and track these delegation records, which is for the audit trail. So current requirements when you are going to be having a delegate is that it should only be appointed during a temporary absence. As I mentioned before, it cannot be for administrative convenience. And the existing paper forms that were used up until Wednesday always had an effective date and a termination date. So the new Minerva menu option fulfills all of those requirements. Each delegation record, you have to enter in an effective date and a termination date. And the maximum length of time that a record can be active is for 1 year. If you try and create a record for a longer period of time, the system does stop you. And as we mentioned and I've said a few times, it became effective on Wednesday. So as a result of this change, of those two paper forms no longer being accepted, financial services, of course, will no longer receive these paper forms. If they're saved on your desktop because they were PDF forms, please don't use them anymore. If you do fill it out and submit it to transaction services, they will come back and they will let you know that you need to log into Minerva and that the delegation records need to be done there. And another thing that arose out of this change is that financial services will no longer review and approve that the delegate is at the appropriate level. So prior to Wednesday with the old paper forms, when a PI would assign a delegate to have signing authority, when that paper would come to transaction services, they would actually go in and they would take a look at to see who's the delegate, what's their status, what is the work that they do in that department, in that unit. So that will no longer happen. The onus now rests on the fund financial manager, on the PI. The new menu clearly indicates that the delegate must be a faculty or staff member who possesses the necessary skills and knowledge for the effective exercise of signing authority. So I know I've repeated that a few times now, so it's very important. We just really want to stress that this is something that now the fund financial manager, the PI, has to be aware of, that they are the ones selecting who is going to be their delegate, and there's no other check in place to ensure that are you delegating to somebody who's at an appropriate level. That is now the decision of the PI. We have updated all of our regulations and policies to make mention of the fact that when you're going to be delegating signing authority, and we have put in that full sentence again, I'll just repeat it a final time, the delegate must be a faculty or staff member who possesses the necessary skills and knowledge for the effective exercise of signing authority. So I've said it lots of times. We all know now that that's very important. Yes.
Who do you have in mind as a staff member? Like, how do you define to which staff member can sign on behalf of FFM?
That's up to them.
Because FSTs are, I guess there has to be some kind of separation of duties in accounting, and until now FSTs at least should not be signing on anything. Is that still in place, or that will be revised?
Okay, I'm just going to let LV answer this one.
So, as has been the case in the past, usually a PI does not delegate normally to an FST or an administrative type person. They usually delegate to a peer or higher up. So I'm thinking the same thing will apply. But again, if they do choose to delegate downward, the person has to be responsible, exactly like what Salima has repeated in the slides. That's what the tri-agency expects. But normally they do give it to a peer or higher up. I was going to say it could potentially also be like a research associate, a lab manager, a senior technician. So it has to be somebody who is able to make a decision on behalf of the PI as to is this cost appropriate for the project.
So it's often going to be those type of people as well. So it wouldn't necessarily be the FSTs because, or an administrative staff, because you're normally not involved in the project, you're not in the lab.
Okay, yeah, because also this new Minerva menu, it's not a change of process. We were simply changing the fact that it's no longer a paper form, it's now an electronic form. The processes that are normally in place, the types of delegates that a PI normally chooses, there's no change in process in terms of that. Yeah, we have one more question.
Yeah, I'm just referring to clear up here.
Yes.
So it says up here reasons why you would want to delegate is leave, and that would include maternity leave, correct?
Any leave that's of a temporary nature, yes.
Okay, good, because we're like a baby factory.
Okay. Okay, yes, go ahead.
Can I just ask you to confirm that once the end date has passed, will the system automatically return to the proper FMF, whatever you call them?
Yes. It's just a system that we'll look at later on where you're able to go in, you're able to query to see what are the active delegation records. Once that 1 year passes and when you do a query to see who are the active delegates for this FFM, you know, on this fund, and once you put that date in, if those records have terminated, then it will show up that there are no active delegates. Okay? Okay, so when would you be preparing these temporary delegation records in Minerva? When the principal investigator or the fund financial manager plans to be away, vacation, sabbatical, leaves, maternity leaves, paternity leaves, whatever they may be, and when they wish to delegate to somebody to sign the paper copy. So we can't stress enough, it's not a change in process. This all has to do with to delegate signing authority for only three document types: travel advances, expense reports, or payment requests. And again, it's a temporary delegate when the PI or FFM is away on a temporary absence. Who would they like to have signing authority for these three particular document types? Who can prepare these records in Minerva? Anyone who has access to the advances and expense reports menu can prepare these records because that's the menu that it resides in. So that means anyone who has access to the employee menu or anybody who has access to the finance menu, anyone who's a FIS user. The principal investigator or fund financial manager, of course, can go in and they can create these delegation records on their funds for themselves. Or a preparer, so that could be an employee, faculty, staff, can also go in on behalf of that fund financial manager, and they can prepare those records. We do have step-by-step instructions that are available in our knowledge base article. We do have a knowledge base article here, how to delegate temporary signing authority for travel advances, expense reports, and payment requests. To show it a bit more. So we discuss a little bit about when to use the menu. We tell you how the records are created, the emails that get sent, which I'll talk about in just a minute. And then we have step-by-step instructions for all of the functions that you can do in this menu. So how would you be confirming temporary delegation records in Minerva? It's similar to the existing functionality for what we already have when you are delegating approvals for purchase requisitions in Minerva. It's set up exactly the same way in that temporary delegation records that are submitted by the principal investigator are automatically approved. They're the fund financial manager. They're logging into this menu option. They are creating a temporary delegation record. As soon as they submit it, it's confirmed, it's active. Temporary delegation records submitted by a preparer, so somebody who is not the FFM, of course, these must be confirmed by the fund financial manager. And as with our other system-generated emails, they will receive an email daily, 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., alerting them to the fact that there are temporary delegation records that are awaiting their confirmation. And just as in those other system emails, it has a link in there. They click on the link, they're prompted to sign into Minerva, and it brings them straight to this new Minerva menu, and they're able to see all of the pending records on their screen, and then they can choose to confirm them or revoke them. Again, instructions about how to confirm are also available in our knowledge base article. So I'm just going to take a minute to actually show you how the Minerva menu option works. Yes.
My understanding is that for if an FFM has an ENSER grant, and that's the only grant she has, she cannot use this, right, for student expense reports?
For student expense reports, here, let me just show you. If I just come down, it's in the Advances and Expense Reports menu. It's the fourth menu option, Delegate Temporary Signing Authority. And just the reason why I'm pulling it up is because it says here there's a note for grant holders. Please note, expense reports charged to tri-agency funds, which are payable to students and visitors, cannot be delegated. So that's correct, because that's one of the requirements.
Okay, but if they have NSERC funds as well as other types of funds, then it has to be entered in here for those other funds. Is that the idea?
If it's not a tri-agency fund, anything that's not a tri-agency fund, then whatever delegate is named in this menu would be able to sign, because they would have the capacity of having the signing authority.
Okay, and also unit heads cannot use this as well?
So unit heads, you're jumping ahead in my presentation. I will deal with that in just a few minutes. Okay. Any other questions? No? Okay. Yes? Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So I did it a little fast. Yes. So as I had mentioned before, this menu option is available in the finance menu or the employee menu. You just have to scroll down and go to the advances and expense reports menu, and it's always going to be the fourth option. It's a delegate temporary signing authority, and it clearly states there it's for travel advances, expense reports, and payment requests during temporary absences. So when you click on it, we just give a little bit of information that a fund financial manager or principal investigator may elect a temporary delegate. I'm not going to read the sentence again. We all know what it says about what that delegate should possess, so I'll leave it at that now. And then we just give you a little bit of information about how to use the menu. When you're using this menu, there are two functions that you can perform. You have a list function, which is the query function to actually view the temporary delegation records. And then you also have the function to actually go in and create or prepare those delegation records, which is the add to one fund, add to multiple funds. So I'm just going to talk about the list function really quickly. When you'd like to list records or query them, you have to enter at least one search criteria in each of these three categories. So you must enter at least one field in the filter by ones. You have a choice to filter by your fund code, by the fund financial manager McGill ID, by the delegate's McGill ID, or even by the preparer's McGill ID. If you wanted to go in and see all of the records that you had created as a preparer, you can actually go in and you can search for it that way. So if I wanted to see temporary delegation records for a fund financial manager, I'll get back to you in just 1 minute if that's okay. All right. So if we wanted to search by fund financial manager, you would just type in their McGill ID. Give me 1 second. So I'm searching to see temporary delegation records for this particular fund financial manager's ID. If I did not know their McGill ID, anywhere where you see a magnifying glass, you can click on and you can do a search by name, first name, last name, and you can look up IDs that way. Same thing for a fund code. You can also look it up by doing a keyword search. So I would like to see all temporary delegation records for this fund financial manager. I'm happy. I would like to see for all three document types. I have a choice. I can deselect the ones that I don't want. In this case, I'd like to see them all. And I'd like to see the active delegates as of. I have a choice that I can put in today's date. I can also go into the past and see as of a date in the past who were active delegates. I can even put a date in the future to see that I know this fund financial manager will be away as of June 1st. Do they have any delegates set up? So I could put in the date of June 1st, and then I can see what are the delegates that will be active as of that date. So in my case, let's say I know I'm going to have some documents that were signed around May 1st. I'd like to see if there were any active delegates for this fund financial manager. I have at least one criteria in my filter by field, so I'm set. I have at least one document type selected. I have at least one mode selected right here. So then I just have to click on list. And when I click on list, and if I scroll down, here is a list of the delegation records which were active as of May 1st. When this table is populated, you always get to see for each record who's the fund financial manager, who is the delegate, it's always the name and the McGill ID, who prepared this temporary delegation record, what fund was it prepared for, what was the document type, because we have a choice of three document types, expense report, travel advance, or payment request. And then, of course, what's important is you get to see the dates. When was this record effective? When did it start? When will it finish? What's the termination date? And what was the confirmation date? So the date that the fund financial manager came into this Minerva menu and they confirmed to say that I agree that this person should be a delegate on my fund for these dates, for this document time. Based on your role, then you'll also have several icons listed under the action menu. Right now, the only one that's available for me would be to copy, and that's just to help you. If you have delegation records that you'd like to copy and then modify because you'd like to create similar ones, you can always copy a delegation record. If I was the one who had actually prepared these records, and if the FFM, the fund financial manager, had not confirmed it yet, I still have time to go in and make changes. Maybe I made a mistake, it was the wrong date, I needed to be an extra week, 1 week less. If I had an edit icon next to that record, I can edit my record. And same thing, if the fund financial manager had not yet confirmed it, and I realize that I just made a complete mistake, it wasn't supposed to be this person, I'll also have a symbol of a trash can and I can revoke it. Right now, since all of these are confirmed, the only person who can now revoke it would be the fund financial manager. So in this case, our fund financial manager was Loretta Bellucci. If she were to sign into this menu option, and if she were to come to this page, and she says, I'd like to see all of my active records as of May 1st, she would have the additional icon here to be able to edit the record. So she can change that termination date if she wants, because she's the fund financial manager. And she also has the option to go in and revoke it. You know what? I've decided I don't want this person to be a delegate for me anymore, or I'm coming back early. So then they can go in and she would be able to come in and she'd be able to revoke it. So that's just a little bit about how that list function works. You don't need to see that part. Did you want me to answer your question now or yet?
So it's a follow-up to this question about tri-agency and students, because there's two ways that students can be reimbursed, from the fund manager's own fund or if they have a research allowance as part of their tri-agency award, which is still under their supervisor as the official fund manager. So does this apply for both those types, where the student is using their own research allowance to get reimbursed for expenses, their supervisor still has to sign it? So there's a difference in source there, and I was just wondering if this temporary delegation can be used for research allowances.
I'm going to let LV answer this one as well.
Okay, so I know that the student refunds and the visiting researchers seems to be a point of confusion. I know I had a conversation with Shelley yesterday for a lengthy time, and we looked at the tri-agency guidelines, and that guideline has always existed within the TAFAG. So to respond to your question, the PIs, first of all, through our analysis, very rarely delegate their signing authority. That's what we've seen. They like to approve their own expenditures. However, if they do have a tri-agency grant, they can still choose to delegate on expense reports, because not all expense reports are for students and or visiting researchers. So they can still choose to delegate for other type of refunds that are not related to students or visiting researchers. But in the case of a refund to a student or a visiting researcher, then they would have to approve that expense when that expense report is completed and ready to submit. That's correct, yes. And for the visiting researchers, they also need to get the one-up signature, so the PI will sign as the authority. However, they have to get the chair or the dean's signature as well to justify the relationship of that visiting scientist to the university. Any other questions regarding that?
Okay, so
if an FFM went into the form to complete it, if he ticked off expense report, and if he ticked off, if he put in there a tri-council fund, would it automatically not let him delegate?
So no, the system will not stop. It doesn't work in that it'll recognize a tri-agency fund and say, oh, stop, you're not allowed, because he is allowed, because there are other expenses that are reimbursable not only to students and visiting researchers. So he can tick off his tri-agency fund, and if an expense report comes through and is for a student, he'll have to sign it. But if it's for something else, then that delegate can sign. That's correct. The question was if the payment, let's say, is to a hotel, then can the delegate sign? Yes, they can. If the researcher, that's another question, and I've written to my contact at Tri-Agency, although it was confirmed via a conference call with him. So if the researcher is on sabbatical leave, the question is, well, then the student won't get paid because the PI is not around to sign. And the answer from Tri-Agency is that an email back from the PI authorizing the expense would be acceptable.
Other signature required for chair, for example?
No.
Just the email?
Just, yes.
So in that case, we just need the claim of the student signature?
No. If there's a refund to a student and the PI is on sabbatical, you want to refund that student, right? You don't want to keep them waiting. So what you do is you email the PI and saying, I have an expense report for said student charged to said fund for this amount for this purpose. Please authorize. Email comes back. I authorize this expense. We attach it to the expense report, and it's acceptable. So I'm waiting for written confirmation from my contact. And once I get that, I will send out a memo via our RAN listserv so everyone understands what is expected if a researcher happens to be on sabbatical.
And this is on sabbatical for sabbatical leaves only?
Any leave. Yeah.
Thank you. Hi. What happens if the person cannot be reached by emails? There's no electronic.
You guys really like to challenge me. it does happen. That's a very good question. So I would imagine that in those instances, it would have to be the chair or the dean. But I will clarify that with my contact at Tri-Agency. Thank you for that.
So for this expense report, does someone sign on the PI's name on the expense report then? Is there no signature? Is the signature blank other than that email?
It would have to be. You would have to attach the email.
But no signature on the expense report?
No. Okay. Right? It would be the email attached. Or if you choose to scan the signature page or the entire expense report to the PI, mm-hmm. then he could sign it and scan it back. Mm-hmm. Then that could be acceptable too.
Your other question, you say visiting researchers' expenses has to be signed by the chair when it is a research fund?
Yes. When it's a tri-agency only for tri-agency.
Okay, thank you.
You mentioned sabbatical leaves. Is this only the case that email authorization would be accepted for approved leaves, like authorized leaves such as sabbatical, medical, maternity, et cetera, or if the FFM happens to be out of town at a conference, would that too be acceptable?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions regarding that topic?
I was just wondering where it says grant holders, please note, if that could be explained a little bit more besides that paragraph that's there, because I know that people are going to go in, they're not going to understand it, and they're just going to assume that, you know, that tri-agency fund, maybe clarify what are the tri-agency funds, like, spell them. I think things have to be spelled out a little bit more, and especially the fact that, you know, students and visitors, like, there's going to be questions there. They're going to wonder why, because I think the bulk of what we do in my faculty the expense reports, they are to students and visitors, so they can't really delegate then. If even if they're not there, it's going to be emails. It's not going to be this form. So I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure, Salima, at what point we can ask for revisions to this menu, but maybe we can put a hyperlink to try agency to explain what funds those are. But we'll take that back and we'll look with our IT people what can be done. Oh, you mean like CIHR? Okay.
That's the only thing.
Okay.
Not all researchers.
Yeah.
These grants are part of TriAgency.
Although I think each researcher at McGill has one of them. So, okay, but that's a good, that's a good feedback. We'll take that back.
Yeah. Okay, so I think I'm running out of time because you've had a lot of questions. So the only thing I wanted to mention about the other function that you can do, of course, in this menu would be to actually go in and create the delegation records. So whether you're creating one delegation record or multiple delegation records, you always have to enter in a fund financial manager ID. And I just want to clarify that if you're going to create one delegation record, that means it's for one person, one delegate's McGill ID on one fund for one document type. So you're either creating for the expense report, for the travel advance, for the payment request. If you need to create multiple delegation records, so it would be for one delegate ID, it's always one delegate ID, but for one or more funds, for one or more document types, then you would be selecting the option of add to multiple funds. Does anybody need me to actually go in and click on it, or we'll be okay? Okay. So if you have any questions, you can always give us a call back. I just want to, again, just give a highlight, just to recap, this new Minerva menu, Delegate Temporary Signing Authority, it replaces two paper forms that used to be on the Financial Services website, which is the Temporary Delegation of Signing Authority and the Travel Advance Signature Delegation. This menu allows any employee or finance user to prepare temporary delegation records. They have the choice to add to one fund or to add to multiple funds. Of course, if someone else is preparing the records, the principal investigator must confirm the delegation record, and of course, they themselves can go into this menu and create the records themselves. And the other thing that this menu allows is for any employee or finance user to query the temporary delegation records, and that would be using the list function. So those are the two functions that this menu allows you to do. In terms of the approvals process for travel advances, expense reports, and payment requests, there's no change in process. You still require a signature. Paper copies must be signed by the principal investigator or the fund financial manager, excluding all the things that we talked about. If a delegate has signed this travel advance, expense report, or payment request, what this menu allows is that local approvers, so members of the FST teams, or central approvers, staff at the travel desk or accounts payable, are able to now log into this Minerva menu, and they, of course, they'll use the list function to search on the date that this document was signed. Who are the delegates on this fund? Is this person allowed to be a delegate? Do they have the signing authority? The question that had been raised before, what happens if you need to delegate in an acting capacity for a unit head during temporary absences? So for this one, it will still remain a paper form. We have a new paper form that we put on our website, which is called Naming a Delegate in an Acting Capacity as Unit Head During Temporary Absences. It's on the forms page of the Financial Services website. If you scroll down a bit, it's the first one that you see right here, naming a delegate in an acting capacity. And it's a PDF form similar to the other two that we have retired. So when you click on it, it just opens up. A little bit of information tells you when you can use it. You have to put in your dates, and then you have to put in the information. Put it back. So when would you use this form? This form is only to be used for vice principals, deans, directors, or chairs who wish to name a delegate in an acting capacity as unit head during temporary absences. If this form is submitted, then there's no need to go into the new Minerva menu and create the temporary delegation records for the travel advances, expense reports, and payment requests. When the form is submitted for someone to be acting as a unit head, it's sufficient to just submit the paper form. Does that answer the question? Yeah, okay, perfect. So if you need help in using or navigating this new Minerva menu option, you can always give us a call at the Finance Help Desk. Our number is 3463, or you can always send us an email. Just a reminder, step-by-step instructions on how to use the new menu and when to use it are available in our knowledge base in our Article 5001. And the other thing that we've also done, to put together all the information about delegation, we did create a new page in our financial policies and regulations section on our website, which is called Delegation of Signing Authority and Approvals. We have links to the two announcements that went out last week, announcing the launch of the new option. And then we also list for you all of the relevant policies and regulations which touch upon delegating for signing authority, along with links of what are the options that you can use. So there's the new Minerva menu option that we talked about today. There's the new form that we've put up when you need to delegate in terms of being an acting capacity for a unit head. And then, of course, the one that's already been around for a while is the one for MMP purchase requisitions that you can delegate for approvals of those orders that are placed in the McGill marketplace. So that was it for my presentation, but I think we have a question.
This new online form covers the three areas that are centrally administered. At the unit level, there are many signatures required for different expenditures from research grants, which include POPS payments, for one. And we used to use the temporary, the paper form, in order to attach that to a POPS requisition along with a timesheet. Is there a best practices being created that would enable us to have a temporary delegation and to attach that, that internal audit would approve? Because it sort of leaves a little bit of a hole now.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to let Elvie answer that one, too.
So we did want to try to incorporate the POPS and the Minerva appointment forms as part of this delegation menu, but it wasn't the right tool for it, and we are looking into another type of repository. And because it's HR-related, they're really the custodians of those delegations. So for now, we'd ask you to maintain the written delegations when it comes to POPS and Minerva. And as soon as we have another solution, of course, we'll bring it to this forum to see if it would be a good solution to put forward.
I appreciate that answer. Just in sometimes when we do contact HR relative to delegation, they tell us to contact financial services and your office. So they never have a specific answer with regards to these kinds of approval processes. And it might be good that financial audit is consulted. So in the event of a POPS audit, which we are getting many of, or I'm sure many people are, it would be helpful to know what they would approve and as well.
So we are working closely with HR to develop other tools that would help this process. And as soon as we have something, we'll bring it to this forum. And I know you're being audited because it's my team that's doing those compliance audits.
Thank you very much.
And we're doing that in response to the Tri-Council audit, just to make sure that the next time they come, we're ready for them and that we do have all the source documents they're looking for. So it's a good thing that we're doing. I know it's onerous at times, but we'll see what the results are of this little mini audit that we conducted, and we are going to get back to the RAND to see what we found.
Has this information already been communicated to researchers?
And I believe communication did go out to the research community.
It went out on the financial services listserv, and I believe also on the RAND.
Yes.
It just might be worth clarifying on the website that this does not apply to POPS payments or appointment forms, just because sometimes they'll believe it covers everything. And I think that was the case when I looked at this, I assumed as such, but it isn't the case. So it might be useful to advise them of that too. Thanks.
Thank you for that.
Okay. Sorry, you said POPS payments, and what was the other one? Appointment.
Minerva appointment forms.
Okay. Okay, so thank you. Sorry it went a little longer then.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm going to go really fast because I don't have too much time and I don't want to keep you here too long. But the fund balances and profile report was developed in response to the feedback that we received from the research community, researchers in particular, due to the fact that they always felt that they didn't have a one-stop shop report where they can see all of their fund balances, and that could be any fund, not just research. That included drill down on payroll details and other expenditure details. So as you know, right now we have two Minerva reports. One is the month-end report that includes all details. But if they needed to drill down on payroll, then they had to go to yet another report. So we brought everything together. And I'm not going to go through all the PowerPoint slides. Maybe I'll go straight to the demo and just walk you through it that way so that we're saving some time. Okay, so just a word, this is a flexible and dynamic report, so it means that it can be run any day and it's updated nightly, so the night before. So all transactions up to the night before will appear on this report, so the balances are pretty much up to the second, if you will, as of the night before. It includes a complete list of funds per PI. It includes available balances, deficits. It also has a legend that helps you track funds that are ending in 30, 60, 90 days. So it will help to go forward action items in order to renew a grant if possible. It has a HR and P card flags, which I'll talk about when I go into the demo. And it also has information related to the fund itself, so the fund, the terms and conditions. So you'll find that in what we call FOA text banner language. What else can I mention before I go in? Once we're finished fine-tuning this report, which is we're pretty close to it, we're going to put it in the RAND site toolbox so everyone can access it. And you can access it using it's based on your fund profile security, the finance fund profile security. So if you have access to see payroll items now on other reports, you'll have access to see that in this report. If you don't, then you would need to have to request that access. And you also need to have access to the finance data warehouse tool. And if you don't, there is in the PowerPoint presentation, there's a link, and you simply would have to go to that link. It's going to prompt you with a few questions. It doesn't take more than 5 minutes of your time, and then you would have access to the data. Did I cover everything? Pretty fast. Okay, so I'm going to...
We can, at the next session, we can come back to this presentation in more detail.
Okay, so I'm going to log in as me. Sorry, I have two screens and I don't usually work that way. So the first login is your email address and your password when you log in the morning. Oops. Okay, so this is the screen that prompts you for, it's the parameters. So whatever you want to see, whatever calendar year, whatever month, and then you would put the PI's ID. So I'm going to put my ID. I don't have research funds, so my stuff looks a little bit different, and don't get alarmed by what you see because a lot of my stuff is balance sheet related, so you're going to see ugly numbers. And then it prompts you for the ID. This is your banner ID. And while this refreshes, I just wanted to acknowledge some groups that helped us develop this report. We did benchmark with the TRIG Advisory Committee that includes researchers and deans, so they gave us feedback. We started off with a really detailed type report, and they told us to pare it down because they just didn't want to see so many details. So we took their feedback into account. We also asked the Faculty Financial Officers for feedback. And Charles, the financial analyst for financial services, is the one that developed this great report. And he's here today in case you have techie questions that I won't be able to answer. Okay. How do I make this? Can everyone see it? Does it look? Sorry, I'm just trying to make it a little bigger so you get everything on the screen. Okay, how's that? Okay, so what the report does is it puts all the activated funds up at the top, and anything that would be terminated you would see at the bottom. So it sorts them that way. It includes all fund types. So it's not just research funds. If I was a researcher and I had an operating fund, it would also show on this list. If I had an unrestricted type fund, it would show on this list. So what it does is it has the previous year balance, including the commitment. What that is the cumulative balance, inception to date, as at the year end of that grant. So if it's a tri-agency grant and it runs from April to March, then that's from inception to March 2013. Okay? The budget, the actual, and commitments pertains to the current grant year. So we just started tri-agency grants starting April 2013. So you would see the budget 2013. You would see actuals starting April 2013, commitments 2013, and that'll accumulate up to March 2014. And then there is a rollover. We have an active flag. And so if there were terminated funds, they would show at the bottom of the list. The fund year-end month, that determines the grant year. So if it's 03, your grant year is April to March. You have a project start date, the fund termination date, the HR flag. So if I had a Y here and you would hover over it, it would say that you still had a Minerva appointment form in the system that has yet to be processed or is a continuing expense on this fund. The P card flag, if I had a Y here and I would hover over it, this is a really neat one. The Y equals the default FOPO. So that means if you have a Y next to a fund, that's your default FOPO for your P card. It will also include an amount when you hover over the Y, and that means those are unreconciled P card charges that will eventually hit that default fund unless someone goes and reconciles and distributes them to the appropriate fund. So I think that's a really, really neat flag. And of course, you have your fund administrator, and further to the right, you also have your FSD contact. Okay, and another nice thing about this report is that you have drillable, anything that's blue you can drill down on. So I'm just going to quickly go on one to show you. So here you can drill down further on expenditures. If I had salaries here, you would see salary and wages, and you could click down and you would see the person's getting paid and the amounts. If I had BSAC transactions, it would be under salaries, and you'd see it under student aid, and you'll see the student names and the amounts they're getting paid. So then you have your account codes, and you can still drill down further, and then you get right down to the details. So it's a one-stop shop report. And one final thing, if you go to we have a legend at the bottom here. So anything that's not highlighted in the available balance column, those are all funds that will expire within 61 to 90 days. If it's highlighted in yellow, it will be 31 to 61 days. And if anything's expiring within 0 to 30 days, it'll be highlighted in red. So these are things you should focus on. So if something's red, maybe it'll need some action items from you or from the PI. So you can alert the PI, this is expiring. Are you renewing? Is there something in the works? Contact OSR. Get that ball rolling before it ends. And gray, of course, it's already expired, and then we have our flags. I think I covered everything. Is there any questions? Do you think this tool would be useful? Yeah? Okay. So what I'll do is maybe talk a little bit more about it in the next session if we have a few minutes, because I went fairly quickly over it. As soon as it's in the RAN toolbox, we will send out a notification. And then we also will inform the PIs that this tool is available for them to use, since they're the ones that were very vocal about having a one-stop shop report. Any questions? Well, thank you. There's one question.
You've got the available balance and it's highlighted in blue. Is there any way you can put the commitments in blue so that if an admin assistant wants to see them, she can just click and it'll show her exactly what's there?
Actually, the commitments, if I had any on my funds, when I do the drill down on available balance, the commitments do show up and you can drill down on commitments.
Cool.
Okay? Yeah. Good question.
Excuse me, is this only Microsoft compatible or what about PC compatible, and what about other systems? Are they compatible with other systems? Because Banner cannot work in Macs.
I'll let Charles reply to that question.
Hi. This report runs off a browser, so it doesn't matter what kind of system you have, as long as you could go onto the internet.
She's having problems with Minerva and Apple. Sorry, I can't hear her. Sorry.
Banners in using a Macintosh? A MacBook Pro or whatever.
I'm sorry, I'm not a technical person. I don't know what those problems are. It doesn't matter. Charles is saying as long as you have access to the web,
okay,
you can click on this link and it brings you right to the web, so you don't need Banner.
Okay, I understand.
Right,
but
it's
what
a
about
web
Safari?
Report?
It applies to Safari, but because different Internet Explorer, I cannot see some of the drill downs.
Well, maybe we'll take that back, Charles. I'm not quite sure what the issues are, but we'll take that comment back and see what our technical people can advise us on.
Hi, sorry, I have another question with regards to any commitments. In terms of Minerva point forms, those are often reflected as an encumbrance or a commitment, but approved POP payments do never appear there until they're actually paid out, and this has proven to be a significant difficulty when people are trying to pay out people, just clear their balances by their grant end date. And we've had this numerous OEs as a result of like POP's payments just sitting there and not being reflected in there. Is there any work being made to try to get approved ones reflected as an encumbrance?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. And I know it's something that's come up in the past. Unfortunately, POPs is a side system, so it's not part of Banner. It's a homemade system, if you will. So we can't capture that information, but I know Brenda, we were working on, somebody else had that exact same concern, and we're looking to see if we could provide at least another report just to show that you can delve into and see what's in the queue or what's waiting to be approved. So we are working on something.
Thank you. Under your commitments, does it show us in dollars?
In dollars?
Yeah.
In yes.
The amount. Okay. And your flags, your HR flags, what are they? I didn't understand that one.
The HR flag, if a fund is terminating, the HR flag is to, if it's a yes, it tells you that there is an appointment form still in the works for that fund.
Okay.
So you'd have to do something. So if the fund is terminating and there's a HR flag, something has to be done with that appointment form to either reassign it, or maybe that fund needs to be renewed, so you need to take an action item.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming. I thought this was a great session, good questions, and we're going to take them all back. Thank you. Oh, and don't forget to fill out the survey when we send out the notice.